Good morning, everybody. I'm Dave, and I'm your pastor, and it's a privilege to be with you here this morning. I want to talk to you about a friend of mine named Bob. Bob is a pastor in Kanata, Ontario, just outside Ottawa. I've actually known Bob for more than 20 years. Bob was a student of my dad's in Nova Scotia, a seminary student, and it was exciting to watch, know Bob over the last 20, 25 years, and he got married and had a child, and then he and his wife had another child. Their son, Owain, their second child, has Down syndrome. Now, Bob and Michelle obviously love both of their children deeply, but having a child with Down syndrome was not their expectation. That was not their plan. And a number of years ago, I was talking to Bob about this and about his experience. And Bob is a very wise man, and he shared some things with me and my wife. He said, when Owain was born, Bob felt some really strong emotions, as one would expect, including grief and frustration. But then, to Bob's own dismay, he started to realize he was also harboring feelings of resentment. And he thought, that's not right. So being the wise and thoughtful, spiritually mature man that he is, that hopefully I someday will be, he recognized that he and his wife were grieving a lot of unspoken and, to be honest, probably unconscious expectations that they had for their son. And they recognized it's not Owain's fault that he's not going to meet their expectations. It's their problem that they had these expectations to begin with, and they had put them on their unborn son. Now, we are all limited in various ways. Owain is limited in different ways than we are, but our limits for all of us often bring painful, difficult emotions. Now, this is Bob's wonderful insight. Bob and his wife, Michelle, Bob said that all parents grieve unfulfilled expectations and disappointments surrounding their children. It's just that most parents have 20 or 30 years over which they grieve those unfulfilled expectations. Bob and Michelle had to grieve them right away. And he said, once we grieved those unfulfilled expectations that were ours, that had nothing to do with Owain, once we grieved those unfulfilled expectations, we were able to love Owain as he is. And they can love him fully and completely because they sorted out their own junk. They sorted out their own expectations on their child. And I suspect it's probably also shaped the way that they love their older daughter, that they've been able to recognize and process their unspoken, unconscious expectations for their daughter that she may or may not ever fulfill. And being able to just kind of love her for who she is and not their expectations of who she will become. So Bob and Michelle, they brought their deep, very uncomfortable feelings to God in humble submission. And they grew tremendously. Bob is a pastor, as I mentioned. I suspect he's been able to transfer this idea of unfulfilled expectations for the way he loves people in his church. He no longer puts unconscious or unspoken expectations on people about what they will be or how they will behave or what they will do, and he loves them for who they are as they are now. Bob and Michelle realized that much of what they were struggling with their son's disability, was their own stuff, not his. And that made a huge difference when they recognized where these feelings were coming from, and they were able to kind of examine and ask the Spirit to purify their own thoughts and expectations and feelings and for their son. Now, grief and loss are difficult emotions. They're not bad emotions. They're actually signs of our limits. In fact, we can grow from these difficult emotions tremendously if we allow God to use them. Instead of fighting them, if we allow God to use them to shape us, we can actually mature in some pretty remarkable ways. I suggest the large part of why God leaves us here on earth after we're saved. Like, I've had people say, why is it that we don't just automatically get to go to heaven? Why do we, as, God's beloved children, why do we still experience all of the hardships of the world? Why isn't our life automatically fixed? And there's a number of reasons why. But certainly, I think one of the big picture reasons why God leaves us here after we've come to Christ is that he knows he can actually grow us and refine us through these hard experiences and these difficult emotions, teaching us through our obedience how to more thoroughly submit to him. Jesus himself learned obedience. He learned obedience to a deeper level by experiencing grief and loss, by going through them instead of going around them. And so in the Garden of Gethsemane, that's a hard thing to say. They should work that into a tongue twister. The Garden of Gethsemane, on the night he was betrayed, Jesus was in deep, distraught prayer. Luke's gospel talks about the sweat, you know, being like great drops of blood, which may actually be an indication. He was under such stress, he was literally bursting blood vessels in his forehead. So Jesus was in deep, distraught prayer. He's praying, take this cup from me, but he's also saying, not my will, but your will be done. Now, these events in the garden are described in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but the author of Hebrews also talks about Jesus' prayers in the Garden of Gethsemane, and that's what we're going to look at. So if you would turn with me to Hebrews chapter 5. If you have a hard copy Bible or an electronic device, Hebrews chapter 5. We're going to read just a couple of verses, verses 7 through 9. Actually, I'll throw on verse 10. Why not? A little bit of extra Bible for you. So contextually, just so you know what the author has been talking about up until now, he's been talking about Jesus being our great high priest, and how he's going through obedience and suffering, not because he was born the Son of God, but he became our great high priest through other reasons. So, picking up at verse 7, the author says, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. So, this is a reference to the loud cries and tears is a reference to the Garden of Gethsemane on the night he was betrayed, that we remember on Good Friday. Then the author goes on. This is important. He says, and he was heard because of his reverent submission. Not he was heard because he is the Son of God. Not he was heard because he was the second member of the Trinity. He's heard, we are told, because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek, which is a reference to the Old Testament that we're not going to go into today. But through his obedience, through suffering, designated by God to be a high priest. Jesus became our mediator with God. Priests are mediators. So the reason that most Protestants don't call their clergy priests is because Jesus is our high priest and we are all priests, which means we have access to God. Jesus is our mediator. He's the high priest who mediates between us and God. And so he was put in this position through his obedience and perseverance in suffering. We're told Jesus prayed to the one who could save him from death, and that Jesus was heard. Wait a minute. Was he? Didn't he die the next day? Jesus was saved from the eternal consequences of death through resurrection. He wasn't saved from suffering. He was saved through suffering. I mentioned this last week because we're talking on the same theme. He was saved on the other side of suffering. Actually, you can think back to the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. And then continues, you prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. That's on the other side. of the dark valley. The reward in the 23rd Psalm, the shepherd, the Lord, the shepherd, prepares the table, his cup overflows, his head is anointed on the other side of the dark valley. And here we see this again. Jesus is, his reward is on the other side of the valley of the shadow of death. Jesus' first request was not granted, that you take this cup of suffering from me. Rather, his significantly deeper foundational request, the foundation upon which the other request was built, was answered. That request was, your will be done, even if it isn't mine. We're told Jesus was heard and saved because of his reverent submission. The word for reverent submission means fear of God or piety. Piety isn't a word we use very often anymore. It's a shame. It's a good word. We tend to talk about people being, pious in kind of a negative way. There's nothing pompous about being pious. When we use it in a negative way, it's because the person's being the opposite of pious. Pious means religious devotion and humble spirituality. So there's a fear of God, reverent submission, humble spirituality here. And again, I want to clarify, fear of God, the word fear has become narrower in meaning over the past couple generations. It doesn't mean a cowering terror fear of God. Rather, it means a healthy respect or a humble respect for God. As a kid, on a few different occasions, I had the opportunity to go horseback riding. And I remember, when you come up to that horse, it's a little intimidating, especially if you're like a 10-year-old. You know, these horses are big, they're powerful, they're strong, they have a mind of their own. And it's a little intimidating. That's a healthy respect. That's a healthy fear of the horse. Like, if you are cavalier about it, you're going to get thrown. It's not, abject fear, I'm going to run away from the horse, I have nightmares about the horse. It's, no, I have a healthy respect for the fact that this horse is bigger, stronger, more powerful than me, and may not do what I want. Wow. Maybe we should think of God that way. He's bigger, more powerful, stronger than me, and may not do what I want. Maybe I need to have a healthy respect for God. And that's what the fear of God means. That's what this reverent submission means. We need a healthy respect or a healthy fear for God, who is so infinitely more powerful than anything we could even imagine, let alone horse. So the Father responded to Jesus' cries because of Jesus' posture of complete submission and abandonment to the Father's will. He wasn't making deals. He wasn't doing an if-then. He was just saying, Father, this is my will, but far more important is your will, even if that's a really terrible experience for me. I want to ask all of us, if we're honest, how often do we actually have a posture of complete submission to God? How often in our prayer life do we have a posture of complete submission to God? How often do we abandon ourselves to the will of the Father? I don't. I'm not good at that. I don't see that a lot in our churches. It was Jesus' complete reliance upon God and complete submission to him that resulted in Jesus' salvation. Not from death, through death. And that's the part that scares us. And to be honest, I think that's why we often, I don't think I want to quite totally abandon myself to God's will, because he might take me through death. It wasn't Jesus' sonship. It wasn't the fact that he was the Son of God that made him our high priest. Nor did his being the Son of God make this an easy road to walk. It was his obedience, his attitude of submission, and frankly, clinging to God in suffering, that made him our great high priest. The reason, just right before that, in the book of Hebrews, he talks about the fact that our priest has suffered like we have, has experienced temptation like we have, and yet he didn't fall. So he is significantly better than all of the other priests in the Old Testament, all of the other priests and high priests throughout history. He is our great high priest because of his humble submission and willing to suffer even though it wasn't his choice. We're told as well, Jesus learned obedience. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that he was disobedient and then learned to obey. Rather, Jesus arrived at or he learned a new stage or a new level of obedience through this obedient submission in times of suffering. You know, it's easy to obey when God is blessing you, right? When God is, you know, granting all of your requests and, oh, all of these wonderful surprises of the goodness of God. It's so easy to obey him then. What happens when those are taken away? In Greek, the word for perfection carries with it the idea of completion. And so when it says that, in verse 8 it says, learned obedience from what he suffered and once made perfect. Well, what, does that mean Jesus wasn't perfect before? No, we're not talking about a moral perfection. We're talking about a completion of his obedience. And so Jesus was made perfect, again, not in the moral sense, he already was, but rather he was made complete in his obedience through actually having to obey the Father, and he finished the race. He made it to the end. He didn't bail. He didn't disobey along that path. And so this completion of his obedience, this perfection of his obedience, led to the resurrection, which then opens the way for all of us to be reconciled to God, all of us who don't finish the race, who don't obey all the time. If we are willing to humbly submit and obey the Father, we too have access to salvation by surrendering to Jesus. Okay, so what does all of this mean? There's a lot of talk about surrender. We don't like that word. There's a lot of talk about obedience. I don't like that word. A lot of talk about suffering. We don't like that word. So what do we make of this? What does it mean? Well, first and foremost, Jesus really deserves our praise and our worship. If nothing else, just remember, Jesus suffered and went through it obediently, and for that alone, he deserves our worship amongst all of the other things. He finished the race, he completed the mission, and thanks to that, you and I can be saved. Without his perseverance, we would not have a path to salvation, and he persevered far beyond anything we've ever endured or experienced. So that's first. Second, Jesus can identify with your suffering. I don't know what you're going through. I don't know what you've been through in the past. I don't know what temptation you're battling. I don't know what feelings of rejection you might be experiencing, what difficult feelings you might be going through. But what I do know is that Jesus has felt those things. Not through the same circumstances, but he's felt those feelings. And so when you are struggling, when you are suffering, when it is hard to persevere, when you are tempted to what seems like the utmost of your limits, Jesus can identify and will come alongside you in those times to strengthen you, which is why he is our great high priest. And so he intercedes for us with God. He stands next to the throne of the Father and intercedes on our behalf. And he does it so well because he knows what we've been through. And we can go to him so much more confidently. You know, early in ministry, I was a pastor. I was single for like 9 years before I met and married my wife. And so I did like at least a dozen weddings in those 9 years. And it was always weird doing like pre-marriage counseling with couples when I've never been married. And I think about, you know, for centuries, priests didn't get married. And how do you go to a priest when you're having trouble in your marriage when none of them have ever been married, right? You don't know what I'm going through. Now, obviously, Jesus wasn't married, but Jesus went through all of our sin, all of our temptation, all of our struggles, different circumstances, same feeling, same experience. Isn't it nice to know that our great high priest knows what we're going through, even if our earthly pastor, priest, or whoever doesn't? Isn't that amazing? Third, Jesus set an example for us in perseverance and obedience. Temptation beats us because we don't persevere. That's what it means to fall in temptation. You didn't persevere, right? We're as parents with our daughter Megan, we're trying to teach her resilience. She's so good at so many things that when something doesn't come easily or when something goes wrong, she gives up and mirror. Right? We've got to teach her how to persevere. We've got to teach her resilience on those few times that something doesn't go right. Well, we fall to temptation because we don't have resilience. We don't resist the temptation. We don't persevere. And so we don't endure. And so eventually we fall in temptation. And Jesus is our example. Jesus is experienced all the temptation to a greater degree and did not stumble. Now, zeroing in specifically, when we have difficult feelings, when we have difficult emotions, we go through difficult experiences, when we run up against our limits, things didn't go the way we wanted, it's tempting for us when we're feeling grief or loss or frustration or anger or disappointment or embarrassment, it's easy for us not to surrender in obedience to God in those moments. We give in to temptation. The temptation to curse God and die, in the words of Job's wife. Why don't you just curse God and die? We allow difficulty in life. We allow losses. We allow frustrations to drive us into disobedience. Even in a secular context, I remember reading a fascinating article about addictive behavior, not just substance abuse, but like shopping addictions, adrenaline addictions, etc. These are coping mechanisms when we're struggling with difficult emotions we haven't processed. And so we resort to some repetitive behavior that brings us some sort of pleasure as a relief to the difficult emotions. So we are not good at processing and dealing with our difficult feelings, our losses, and our frustrations. They drive us to disobedience. They turn us to bitterness. They turn us to sinful responses to God and others. We allow bitterness to lead to unrighteous anger. There is righteous anger. There are things about which we should be angry. But too often, we turn to unrighteous anger. We allow it to drag us from God. We lash out. We blame other people for our frustration or our grief or our loss or our limits. Let me just say, if anyone had reason to blame other people for their experiences, it was Jesus between the Garden of Gethsemane and Easter morning, right? If anybody had reason to blame other people for his circumstances and experiences, it was him. And yet he humbly submitted to the Father's will. He persevered, and because of that, we are saved. Perseverance teaches obedience. Obedience is hard. Obedience goes against our sinful will, our sinful nature. That's the Garden of Eden. What is the sin? It's disobedience. Right? Obedience doesn't come easily. Even for Jesus, it was a great struggle when he knew his obedience would lead to unjust suffering of unimaginable proportions. It was hard. And so if we learn to persevere in obedience with a posture of humble submission, we will find completion, a new level of obedience, a perfection to our obedience. But we have to persevere. Experiencing our limits, such as grief or loss or frustration, teaches us how to submit our will to God. These are opportunities, hard opportunities, but opportunities to humbly remember that God is not limited like we are. It's a reminder that we are his creatures, not the other way around, and that our role is to surrender to him. You notice in Jesus' prayer in the Gospels, it wasn't described in Hebrews, but his prayer is that the suffering will be taken from him, but always in the context of, not my will, your will be done. This isn't just an empty phrase he tacks on at the end of the prayer. I know so often in our prayers, we say, Lord, you know, but not my will, your will be done. Really? We kind of say it like abracadabra at the end. How many of our prayers are about our will being done? Bless me, heal them, move this, do that. Yes, it's appropriate to bring our requests to God. Jesus said, pray for daily bread. Pray for forgiveness. Pray that you're not tempted. Of course we need to pray. But is our attitude of prayer, is our posture of prayer in these moments a humble surrender to the desires of God first? Or is it our desires and we're like, oh yeah, and Jesus said, pray, you know, in your will done. Yeah, okay, in your will and in his name. Our prayers are often about God doing our will, not surrendering to God's will. I do it too, right? I'm not trying to lay blame. I'm trying to shine a light on all of the way that the church, especially in North America, seems to function. Most of our requests are consistent with what we think God's will might be in the hopes that it aligns with our will. But do we stop and surrender our desires to God? How thoroughly do we surrender our desires to God? My desire is for comfort and ease and for things to go smoothly. Unfortunately, it doesn't really seem to be God's will that often. Are we willing to submit to God when the feelings are dried up? When there's nothing left but just this naked will clinging blindly to God? Are we willing to surrender to him at that point? And yet, in those moments, hours, days, weeks, years of just the blind will clinging to God, that's the crucible where our conceit and our pride are purged from our souls. And that's where we're trained in pure love. It isn't pleasant, but it is good. This is why God allows his people to endure living in a sinful world. Living in a broken world teaches us how to submit to God, to surrender and to obey. We may get to a much deeper exploration of this idea, but before God created the world, he knew he would have to redeem it. Jesus was not plan B. The cross, the atonement, were plan A the whole time. So before God said, let there be light, the Son had already said, I will die for their sins. The Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. The people whose names were written in the book of life before the foundation of the world. Why? Why did Jesus have to know he would die for our sins before God created the world? Because God's goal was to create free-willed creatures, because who are capable of loving him. Love is an exercise of free will. So he wanted to create free-willed creatures capable of loving him, but he knew free-willed creatures would sin. Free will means, hey, you know, you're free to do not, you know, free to do not to do. And so how do you solve the problem of creating free-willed creatures that don't sin? Well, you create free-willed creatures that do sin, and then you redeem them. After a lifetime of living in a world tainted by sin, God's redeemed people in the recreated world will say, been there, done that, not going there again. And so you have free-willed creatures who freely love God and don't sin because they've been through that already and seen how bad that is. But during our lifetime, we need to see how bad the sinful world can be. And we need to learn obedience through the struggle of living in a fallen world so that we will remember when we too have been resurrected. So Jesus learned a new level of obedience through his time of suffering, and so can we. Jesus had a condensed experience of suffering at the cross, right? He took on the sin of the world on the cross. He went through a condensed time of far more suffering than we do. Our suffering is typically spread out over the course of a lifetime. But like Bob and Michelle, when they realized their son would never live up to the unspoken and unconscious expectations they had for him, their grieving for their son was compressed. And now they can just live, loving their son for who he is. Jesus, his time of suffering was compressed, deeper than ours. We experience that over the course of a lifetime. Unlike Jesus, we fail repeatedly. And so we have to learn to get back up, dust ourselves off in repentance, and keep persevering in obedience. Now, if we never experience difficult times, if we never experience difficult emotions, we wouldn't learn to obey. Right? It's easy to obey when everybody agrees and everything is going great. When God is doing your will, it's so easy to obey him. It's hard to obey when things are going badly. Okay. So how then do we apply this? There's two levels I want to address to apply this. First is our own personal experience as believers, as people trying to follow God, living in a broken world, experiencing painful experiences and deep, difficult emotions, and what do we do with them? But then also, I want to apply this to our church as a whole, to Church at the Center, to Falling Brook Heights. And how do we apply this as a congregation? Okay, so we're going to go personal and then corporate. So first, personal, realize our limits are not bad. They're frustrating. They're not bad, right? Grief, loss, frustration are not evil. They are unpleasant. But they're kind of like a smoke detector telling us something is wrong. They're like a warning light on your car dash. In the West, comfort has become our god, our idol. And so we avoid discomfort at almost all costs. Uncomfortable things, we avoid them like the plague. But we miss out then on opportunities to grow. So because comfort has become our idol, when we feel uncomfortable things, we don't know what to do with them. This is heresy. I live in the wealthiest, you know, part of the world in all of history. Why am I experiencing these things? And so we stuff those feelings, or we deny those feelings, or we try to avoid those feelings, or we blow the feelings out of proportion. Oh, the sky is falling. Because we don't know how to handle them. But either way, they become opportunities for the devil to sow seeds of bitterness and resentment in our heart. He's just waiting for us to feel these feelings and not bring them to God because the feelings are there. So either he'll use them or God will use them. And so these difficult feelings can then spill out in unrighteous anger, in toxic behavior. Instead, what we need to do is when we feel that initial feeling of grief or loss or frustration or I'm hitting a limit of some sort, why isn't this working the way I want it? We need to take these to God and we need to surrender them and surrender ourselves to him and say, God, this isn't working. This isn't what I wanted. Work this out. What is your will here? Help me to obey. Help me to obey in terms of showing the fruit of the Spirit even when I don't feel like it. Help me to obey, not to be mean and toxic to the people around me, not to turn my back on you because you're not doing what I want. In these times, it is in these times we actually learn obedience, where we actually grow. God draws us closer to himself and he refines us through these times. And so, you know, some people think that Christians have to be happy all the time. Rejoice in the Lord always. That's a misunderstanding. To rejoice in the Lord always doesn't mean to rejoice in negative feelings. It means that we bring them to the Lord and we rejoice in him, not our feelings, not our circumstances. Jesus did not teach us to stuff down our emotions. He experienced them. He experienced grief and sorrow and anger. He wept over Jerusalem. He was angry. He snorted in anger. John's gospel tells us, like, he snorted in anger. It's the word used for a horse snorting in anger. When he saw Lazarus' sisters and the people weeping, he snorted in anger at the way that death has affected people. Paul says we are to mourn with those who mourn. So we are to join one another in times of sorrow, not deny the sorrow or say, keep a stiff upper lip, it's okay. Grief, loss, and frustration are related to our limits. They're expressions of our limitations that we are not God. Over just a couple of weeks, as I've been here, and I've heard a lot of stories from people in our church about grief and loss, and frankly, from frustration as well. Obviously, we've talked a lot about the closing of the Reach and the departure of Pastor Ken, and these are sad and these are grief-filled moments. But I'm hearing a lot of frustrations about other things too. Frustration is another limits feeling. Frustration is, it's not going the way I want. And if I was God, it would go the way I want. So I'm not God, and that's frustrating. We need to be diligent in bringing our frustrations to God in humble submission. I know one source of frustration that we've been dealing with that we're going to try and work with over the next number of months is communication. and clear guidelines for our leaders and our volunteers. You know, it's funny, I mentioned this in my sermon 2 weeks ago. I mentioned governance, and at the time it was kind of a throwaway comment about governance, because who cares about governance, right? Church governance, oh, just so boring and dry. Whoa, little did I know the significance of governance, it would be a significant issue. I actually like to think that was the Spirit at work instead of me. The Spirit saying, oh, guess what? I know where you need healing. And so in cooperation with the Spirit, we're going to find some healing and do some work over questions of governance, because our limited governance has actually led to lots of frustration. Governance is a form of communication. It's letting people know who's responsible for what, how decisions are made, and who has what job. When governance is missing, it actually becomes frustrating for people because they don't know how decisions were made. They don't know how to make new decisions. They don't know. And governance actually gives us lanes of authority and responsibility. Now, it might seem like, hey, you know what? If you take away the lane markers, if you take away the walls and the partitions, won't that be great? We'll have all of this freedom. But let me propose to you that the province comes in and they take away all of the lane markers and barriers on the 401. Traffic is bad enough as it is, but can you imagine if they just painted all of the pavement black, took away those guardrails down the middle, just painted all black and said, free for all, go for it. Would you get anywhere? No, you wouldn't get anywhere. So how can a leader or a volunteer stay in their lane if they don't have lane markers? If you don't even know where your lane is, but you know you're supposed to get stuff done, how frustrating is that? If you don't know where accountability comes from, how do you trust that other people are making good decisions? And so it seems with a lack of governance that, oh, isn't this great? We're all free to do what we were called to do. And until you bump into somebody else, right? The big wide 401, you know, drive on either side of the road, all that blacktop is great when you're alone. As soon as you put a few thousand more cars on there, you've got problems. So frustration is a reminder that we are not God. Frustration is a sign that things are not as they should be. Now, the fact that you're frustrated doesn't mean you do know how they should be. Like, just because you're frustrated doesn't mean you should have gotten your way, but it's a sign that something isn't working. Or that things, you know, but frustration is a sign something isn't working right, and so that needs investigation. And ultimately, it boils down to the fact that we're living in a fallen world. Part of my role as your shepherd in times of change is to help us discern what's wrong and how do we best go about fixing that. And that's going to take some time, but we're going to work on it. But it's actually an opportunity as a congregation to submit to God and to learn to obey and follow Him even when we're frustrated. As a church, we need to learn how to deal with negative experiences and negative feelings. Our discipleship needs to incorporate grief and loss and frustration. Discipleship means to radically follow Jesus. Jesus repeatedly said that to follow Him means taking up your cross to follow Him. That's not a pleasant experience. The cross is a sign of suffering and grief and loss, but many times our discipleship in the West ignores these emotions and these experiences. And so what we actually need to do, we need to teach one another what to do with these feelings and how to bring them to Jesus as tools to shape our character, as tools to teach us obedience, as tools to make us more like Jesus. So I think about maybe your experience or people you know. How many people do you know who have left a church because the church didn't handle anger well? They left the church because people would yell at each other in meetings, or people would yell at each other in the foyer. Churches are full of angry people who sin in their anger. This is a discipleship issue. Churches need to teach and expect people to handle their emotions well. Too often we allow Christians to let their anger simmer and then explode. Too often when people are feeling difficult emotions, we model for them, just hide it. Just smile and nod. All right? Just pretend it's all right. We're at church. We're saved. Nothing wrong could be happening in our lives. And then people explode or they implode and we're shocked. What happened to them? I had no idea they were struggling. Really? Because you didn't give them an opportunity to share that they were struggling, and you modeled that everything has to be perfect all the time until you explode. But not only should this affect the way we disciple people and one another, it should affect our evangelism too. We need to be really careful that when we spread the gospel, we don't sell unrealistic expectations. What you win people with, you win them to. What you win people with, you win them to. If you present Christianity as a ticket to the easy life, that Jesus is going to solve all your problems, then people are won to an easy life. And when life gets hard, they say, well, that was a lie. I'm not going to have anything to do with that anymore. This is the problem with the prosperity gospel. If you win people with flash and glitz at your church, not a struggle we have here. But if you win them over with a light show, that's what they come for. And when a new church opens that has a better light show, that's where they go. Or when difficulty comes, the flash and the light show, they don't help, and people fall away. What you win people with, you win them to. If you win people with all it takes is say a prayer, and then you're a Christian, and then that's all they do, they say a prayer. And then you say, well, why aren't you going to church? Well, because you told me all I had to do was say a prayer. Why aren't you serving at church? You said all I had to do was say a prayer. Why aren't you giving a church? You said all I had to do was say a prayer. What you win people with, you win people too. When difficulty comes, I said the prayer. What happened? Contrast that with Jesus' words. Jesus presented people with the hard truth so there would be no surprises during difficult times. Jesus said things like, take up your cross and follow me. The Son of Man will be executed and on the third day raised again. Or, blessed are you when they persecute you for my sake. Jesus did not sugarcoat the cost of following him, so when grief, loss, pain, frustration, hurt, persecution come along, his followers wouldn't be shocked. How often are we shocked? How often do we sugarcoat the gospel in our evangelism because we really want them to come to church? Don't sugarcoat the gospel. Contrast that with a what if. What if, as a church, we won people to Christ by modeling how to handle difficult feelings really well, by modeling how to handle conflict really well? What if we modeled mourning together, not just celebrating together? In a highly polarized world, I think that might be really attractive. So don't hide from feelings of grief and loss. Don't stuff down frustration and anger. Instead, bring them to God. In humble submission, piety, in humble submission, surrender the situation to God and learn to obey him through these difficult feelings. Jesus learned new, complete, perfect levels of obedience through suffering. And so can we. Having grieved our losses well, maybe we'll learn to love people as they are, instead of as we expect them to be or want them to be, like Michelle and Bob and their son, Owain. Certainly, God would really love to use these opportunities here at Church at the Center for us to grow and for us to mature and for us to be sanctified and then to shape us as a congregation to be more like his son. We can and should do that individually, and we need to work on that as individuals because it's an individual exercise to submit to God. But we can also do that as a church by raising expectations for that, by modeling that, by offering that, by joining people in that. We can learn to grieve the things that grieve God, and so that we can see the world through his eyes and keep in step with him. Would you pray with me? Father in heaven, we come to you with the reminder that we are not God. We are limited. In our sinful nature, we don't want to be limited. We want to be like God. And Father, forgive us for all of the times in little ways. I don't think any of us would ever say, I want to be God. But in so many situations, we want our will to be done. God, you have given us limits. And sometimes our frustration and our grief and our loss are reminders of those limits. And they're painful reminders. I pray that you would teach us as a church family to come to you in those times of frustration and grief and loss, and that we would come to one another so that you can refine us the way that you refined your son Jesus, so that you can teach us new levels of obedience. Father, I think in particular of Pat Ewell. I know that she's in the hospital and she's recovering, and that's great. I pray that you would help us as a church to walk alongside her in times of grief, that we would walk with her so that she knows she's not alone, but also so that we can grow with her and learn new levels of obedience in times of suffering alongside her. Father, I pray for each of us in our lives as we go, whether it's family life, work life, school life, neighborhood, when we run into these limits that are frustrating, when we run into these limits that grieve our hearts, you would teach us that our first response needs to be to come to you and say, what in this situation grieves your heart? What in this situation frustrates you? Not my will, but your will be done. I pray this in Jesus' name.